This talk is about the past. To be specific, about the history of an earlier part of this century, when the leading nations of the world were locked in a titanic conflict which has left its mark upon us ever since. Some may say, why dig up the past in this way? Why not let it rest? Surely the present and the future are what matter. That is a reasonable argument, and there are many cases when I can accept it. But World War II, and the political and ideological divisions that led to it, are a special case which cannot be buried in this way. The whole climate of political life today, the whole world we live in, has been shaped by those events and by our reading of those events. Unless we understand them, we will not see a clear path out of our present crises and towards the future salvation of our people. Let me make this clear at the beginning. Nothing that I may say in this talk is intended to belittle the heroic efforts of my own countrymen, the British servicemen of 1939-45, or their allies of other nations, in a cause which they believed at the time to be just. No end of slush has been printed and spoken about the alleged principles for which they are supposed to have gone to war. But when we get down to the simple truth, we must acknowledge that they fought for one reason only. They were persuaded that their country and their people were in danger, and that the national interest demanded that they take to arms. My purpose here is to establish that in our calculation of what was the national interest at that time, and what were at that time the dangers to our country and people, an error was made, the enormity of which has shaped the entire course of events ever since. That error was not the fault of British servicemen, for it was not their job to make such decisions. The error was the fault of our political leadership, the political leadership that has been wrong in its reading of every vital issue of the 20th century, and wrong most of all in its reading of the situation leading to the declaration of war on Germany on September the 3rd, 1939. Before we examine that situation, let us look first at the consequences of that war. Our own country, Britain, was only able to achieve military victory at the cost of total economic exhaustion and with the aid of allies to whom she had to concede the hegemony of the post-war world and the sacrifice of the British Empire. Half of Europe has been brought under Soviet rule. A toll in death and blood was paid whose effects are incalculable. Many millions of the finest men among the white races were killed in battle, and millions more were killed by bombing and starvation. None of the objects for which we are told Britain went to war have been achieved. We went to war, they said, in defense of the sovereignty of Poland and of other nations in Eastern Europe. None of these nations today is sovereign. We went to war, they said, to oppose dictatorship and militarism. Dictatorship and militarism are as rampant now as they were in 1939, with the difference that today's dictators and militarists of the Soviet Union have ambitions of expansion everywhere, while Hitler only had ambitions of expansion southward and eastward. Today, the Soviet Union and its allies represent a far greater menace to world order and peace than will ever have been claimed of Nazi Germany and the other Axis powers. We went to war, they said, in order to protect Britain from the hegemony of a continental overlord, to protect our freedom and independence from a foreign yoke. Today, we are neither free nor independent, but take our orders from the bureaucrats of the common market. We went to war, they said, to defend Britain from the threat of invasion. But the fact is that over the past 30 years, we have suffered an invasion of this country far more foreign, in terms of its impact upon our traditional way of life, than we could ever have faced in 1940. Could these things have been foreseen in 1939, when war was declared? Declared by Britain, mark you, not by Germany. I submit that those who could not foresee them were fools, in no way fit to be in charge of national affairs, while those who could foresee them were evil men, guilty of deliberate treason to their country. Let us now trace the events that led to this most catastrophic calamity in British and European history. After World War I, a calamity of almost equal magnitude, Britain and the nations of Europe found themselves in a situation of the deepest crisis. An old world had been destroyed, never to return, but no new world worth living in had been constructed in its place. In every country, there was poverty and hunger that affected millions. Technology had increased our power to produce by leaps and bounds, yet throughout Britain and Europe, the old national leaders seemed incapable of harnessing this new productive power for the benefit of the people. Everywhere there was instability and turmoil. Everywhere the old order had broken down, but no new order had emerged to replace it. Only the anarchy of the conflict between political parties and rival interest groups. An anarchy which in some countries was intensifying to the point of full-scale civil war. And in every country, little men, the pygmies of politics thrown up by the parliamentary system designed to raise those of the smallest stature to the positions of greatest power and responsibility. Everywhere the little men of politics dithered and palpitated in the face of this crisis. In France there were Briand, Poincaré, and Leon Blum. In Italy there was Giolitti. In Germany there were Ebert, Bruning, and Stresemann. And in Britain there were MacDonald and Baldwin. These were the men of inaction, whose policy was one of muddling through in the face of the tremendous crises hitting their countries. Everywhere the pygmies ruled and showed themselves wholly incapable of grappling with the immense problems of peace and progress that followed 1918. And over the horizon, above the heads of these little men and their endless babbling committees, there loomed the ghastly specter of communism, of Red Revolution. This revolution had already devoured one major country, Russia, and the threat of it hung over the whole of Europe. The threat was greatest of all in Italy, Germany, and Spain, where the degeneration of political life had reached the lowest levels and where economic crisis hit the pockets of the people hardest. In France and Britain, the gravity of this crisis and the state of general collapse differed from these other countries only in degree and in timescale. It was then in the aftermath of World War I that national revolutions occurred, first in Italy, then later in Germany, then later in Spain. I say national revolutions because these revolutions were wholly different to that which had taken place in Russia in 1917. The revolution in Russia was an alien movement, led from the outset predominantly by international Jews who shared no common bond with the Russian people. Their purpose was not to reconstruct Russia for the Russians, but merely to use Russia as a springboard for a greater revolution that was to convulse the world. But the revolutions in Italy, Germany, and Spain were of an entirely different order. First of all, they were not revolutions for export. They were patriotic risings led by people sprung from the soil of those countries and concerned with the welfare of those countries alone. While the ambitions of Soviet communism encompassed Britain and the British Empire, the leaders of the national revolutions in Italy, Germany, and Spain never coveted any British possession nor threatened any British interest. It forms no part of my subject here to argue the pros and cons of everything that happened in Germany, Italy, and Spain in the process of the revolutions that occurred in those countries. That is another study entirely. It does not belong to this talk. What is most relevant to us now are the effects which these revolutions had for Britain and the response to them of our own politicians at the time. Since those effects and the way in which our own leaders responded to them bear upon our lives right to this day, it's important that we should understand what happened in that crucial period of our history, what happened and why it happened. Let us look now for a moment at the scenario of the 1930s. On the continent of Europe, there were three powers, three countries in which revolutions had taken place, one of them communist, Russia, and the other two nationalist, Germany and Italy. The other revolution, that in Spain, not materializing until the later part of that decade. In all three countries, Russia, Germany, and Italy, the leaders were pursuing aggressive and expansionist foreign policies. And for that purpose, they were building up their armed forces. Italy had ambitions in Northeast Africa. Germany wanted to annex Austria on the grounds that its people were ethnically German. And it laid claims to parts of Czechoslovakia and Poland on similar grounds. Russia had territorial claims on parts of Finland and the Baltic states, while quite clearly she was sponsoring Soviet-style revolutionary movements in almost every other country of significance in the world, financing and instigating disorder and unrest in all those countries. And in the background, there was the prophecy which Hitler had made in his book Mein Kampf, written several years before he came to power, that Germany's quest for living room and resources would eventually lead her to an expansionist drive into other parts of Eastern Europe, which by implication included Russia. A war between Russia and Germany, therefore, was always likely as the final outcome of the unsettled situation that existed in Europe during that period. Now, what were Britain's leaders to do in the face of this situation? Let us assume, to simplify the matter, that nearly all of these leaders disliked the types of regimes that had come to power in Russia, Italy, and Germany. They disliked the internal politics of those countries. They disliked fascism and national socialism just as they disliked communism. It's fair to assume this because it most certainly was true. But dislike of a foreign country's internal politics has never been a proper basis on which to decide foreign policy. If we decided that we would actively oppose in international affairs every country whose internal regime and whose internal way of life was not to our taste, why, we would spend our whole time engaged in conflict with hundreds of countries all around the world. The very idea is ridiculous. Throughout the great ages of Britain's growth and development, this never was a rule of foreign policy. Our leaders were interested in a foreign country's politics just to that extent and no more that those politics affected us. Foreign policy was conducted on the basis of what was good for Britain. We made friends with those countries with whom it was in our interest to make friends. We opposed those countries whom it was in our interest to oppose. Like or dislike of those countries' way of government had nothing to do with it. In this way, we made alliance with Prussia against the French in the Napoleonic period, then again with France against Russia in the Crimean War, then again with Japan in the earlier part of the 20th century. All alliances determined by a sober consideration of the national and imperial interests of Britain. When Britain did intervene in a war on the continent, it was for a strategic purpose. In other words, our intervention was decided by considerations of strategy and not of morality. When we were locked in a struggle with France for hegemony in North America and other colonial areas, we very rightly opposed France in Europe for the obvious reason that it was in our interest to weaken France. In this process, we found ourselves much more often than not in alliance with the various German states and with Prussia in particular. It didn't matter that our allies organized their affairs internally in a vastly different way to the way we did. What mattered was that we had a community of interests. It was only in the 20th century that a new standard of foreign policy became rooted in this country and we started to make judgments in international affairs clouded by our emotions rather than shaped by cold, hard considerations of national policy. I need hardly say that when nations start to think in this effeminate way, those nations are headed for trouble. Now, if there was one power in the world in the 1930s that was quite clearly an enemy of this country by the whole nature of its international political ambitions, that power was Soviet Russia. Soviet Russia was, as I've already indicated, sponsoring movements of internal subversion in Britain and all over the world. Soviet Russia was the leader of international communism, and international communism has never made any bones of its hostility to the British Empire, an institution which both Marx and Lenin at various times stated must be destroyed if world communism was to triumph. In addition to this, Soviet Russia represented, by the sheer immensity of its size and resources, natural resources and resources of manpower, by far the greatest potential danger to Britain and its interests of any country that might be hostile to us. If two groups of people appear not to like you, yet are seen to be making aggressive noises which you think may represent a threat to you, it's common sense to be on your guard most of all against the one who has the greatest capacity to harm you if it comes to a fight. If you can't fight both, you clearly must fight the one who represents the bigger danger. In all human affairs, this has always been elementary logic. So whatever decisions made by British statesmen in the 1930s, the first rule of all policy had to be that nothing should be done to give aid and comfort to Soviet Russia. Nothing should be done to strengthen Russia. Everything possible should be done to weaken Russia, at least in respect of her capacity to exert weight and influence in international affairs. Now let us return to the scenario of the 1930s, part of which I've already described. Germany and Italy had ambitions of expansion, but not, on the evidence available, in areas of the world where they may threaten us. Soviet Russia, on the other hand, clearly had ambitions which did threaten us in the most obvious and dangerous way. Quite clearly, if you believe that the communist and fascist powers represented evils, you have to accept that the fascist powers were a lesser evil. Quite clearly, British interests much more strongly required the stopping of communism than they required the stopping of Hitler and his allies. And what were the aims of Hitler? Let us now look into them in a little more detail. It's often said by opponents of National Socialism that too few British leaders in the interwar period ever took the trouble to read Mein Kampf and to get to understand what was in Hitler's mind. I agree with this assessment, although perhaps for different reasons. Three things emerge clearly from Mein Kampf. Firstly, Hitler wanted all the people of German race to live in one single unified Germany. This included the German element in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, from which incidentally he originated himself, and those German ethnic minorities that had been incorporated within the borders of other countries as a consequence of the defeat of 1918 in the Treaty of Versailles, the main ones being the Sudeten Germans of Czechoslovakia, and the Germans who had been cut off from their fatherland by the artificially created Polish corridor to the Baltic. Secondly, Hitler wanted Germany to be a great power, and by that he meant a power with the territorial resources to accommodate a vast increase in population, and to provide the natural economic resources to support such a population without dependence upon imports. Thirdly, Hitler wanted, in pursuit of these aims, the friendship and alliance of Britain. In page after page of Mein Kampf, he made clear his admiration of the British people and of their imperial achievements. He saw the British as being the other great Aryan power, the most racially kindred to Germany of all the major nations. But above all, his desire for the friendship and cooperation of Britain was a completely practical one. Britain and Germany had no fundamental reason for conflict. No legitimate British interest justified an anti-German policy, or vice versa. Germany's policy, so far as Hitler was concerned, was an Eastern policy, Ostpolitik, as it was called. The East was the one area where it was practical for Germany to seek her extra living room. The East was the area where German minorities had to be liberated from a foreign yoke. What Hitler wanted was that while he pursued his Eastern policy, no power or combination of powers would threaten his Western flank. Good relations with Britain were therefore vital to the carrying out of Hitler's aims of foreign policy. He made this clear in Mein Kampf and in all his efforts at diplomacy after he had become German Chancellor. So these were the aims. Let us now consider how reasonable those aims were, how right or wrong they were. Were they the sort of aims that we would pursue if we were in Germany's position? First of all, the aim of incorporating all racially German communities in one German Reich. Was this an evil proposition? Let us suppose that there were British communities, which by the fortunes of history had been cut off from Great Britain and annexed within the borders of some other state. Supposing that, as a consequence of an unsuccessful war against France, the counties of Kent or Sussex had been taken from us and incorporated into France. And supposing that there was strong indication that the people of those counties had shown an overwhelming desire to return to Britain, what would be our policy in such a situation? Would it be right to brand the British as international aggressors if they sought to liberate their own people by all possible means? How then can any Briton, in his right mind, object to that principle being applied in the case of Germany? It was a totally reasonable principle, and Germany's wish to put it into effect was a perfectly reasonable wish. Now, some may say, all right, if that was as far as German ambitions extended. But we know that they extended further. Germany was not going to be satisfied merely with the acquisition of lands that were racially German. This was only the first step. She was to go on to occupy the whole of Czechoslovakia, and did she not want this great Eastern European empire, which included parts of Russia, for her Lebensraum? Surely this was not right. It was not right because it was bound to involve an aggressive war against Germany's neighbors. Surely Britain could not stand by and let this happen. Well, the first answer to that question is that Britain has indeed stood by and let just such things happen throughout her long history. She's done so because she's had no alternative. You just can't go everywhere acting as the world's policeman or the world's magistrate. Time beyond count, we've had to witness one country wage aggressive war against another and annex its territory. And we haven't intervened. We haven't intervened because, considering the situation soberly, we've realized that the consequences of intervention would be far worse than the consequences of non-intervention. It is at these moments that we have to swallow our sense of moral outrage, whether that be justified or not, and determine our policy on the basis of what is the British interest. We watched Czechoslovakia be crushed by the Russians in 1968, and we didn't intervene. We watched Hungary crushed by the Russians in 1956, and we didn't intervene. Have we intervened in the Russian annexation of the Baltic states? Have we intervened in the Russian invasion of Afghanistan? Or did we intervene in the American annexation from Mexico of vast stretches of what are now the southern and western United States? Why then should we intervene when Germany takes measures, aggressive measures though they may be, to aggrandize herself at the expense of her neighbors in Europe? What is so special about that situation? And what about our own record anyway? Just who is Britain, or for that matter France or America, to howl in moral indignation when countries expand their territories by conquest? I have mentioned already the record of America with regard to Mexico. And we must not forget the continual expansion of the white American colonists westwards at the expense of the native Indians. Would it be better if this had never happened? Would it be better today if the whole of the North American continent was a wilderness occupied only by redskins? America, France, and Britain, the nations which in the 1930s were clucking their disapproval of Germany's expansionist policies in Europe and Italy's expansionist policies in Northeast Africa, were the very nations that had built for themselves vast domains by that very same process of military conquest over weaker races. Adolf Hitler once said of those people in his own country who disapproved of the conquest of territory and resources by military means, the pacifists, in other words, that those same people do not hesitate to eat the bread provided from the land of the territories that have been conquered. And indeed, the same may be said of those people in our own country who hold similar sentiments. These people are nothing better than humbugs, humbugs of the worst kind. And humbug was the overriding feature of all the propaganda of the 1930s which attacked the fascist powers only for doing what the democracies had done themselves at an earlier stage of history. There was only one possible basis on which Britain would have been justified in interfering with Germany's program in Europe, and that was the likelihood that Germany, once she had completed her eastern conquests, would turn around and march against us, or against some part of the British Empire. Now, just how great was this likelihood? I've examined already Hitler's declarations of goodwill towards the British nation and his wish to have an alliance with us. Of course, some will say that was just a piece of trickery designed to put us off our guard. But if Hitler had been disposed to employ such trickery, would he have been so honest at the same time to give clear evidence, as he did in Mein Kampf, that he saw Russia as the power which eventually Germany would have to attack, and the lands of Russia as the lands which would provide German living room? Surely he would have employed the same kind of trickery to put Russia off her guard, too. Later, of course, he did employ that trickery by means of the German-Soviet Pact of 1939, after Britain had gone to war with Germany and the whole rules of international diplomacy had changed. But when Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, he had no such subtle thoughts in mind. He was expressing frankly and truthfully his future program, the program that he was later to carry out to the letter. Perhaps the only instance in modern times of a politician who told the people in advance exactly what he was going to do, then did it, with no breaking of promises and no deviation. In that case, there's overwhelming evidence that the attitude he expressed towards Britain was in fact his attitude, and not some ploy to mislead the British. And was this not confirmed in 1940? When Hitler's armies had driven the British and French armies to the Channel, the German armies were halted on Hitler's orders and against all the advice of his military chiefs, so as to allow the British expeditionary force to escape back to Britain. Hitler explained this action as being to facilitate the business of coming to peace terms with the British, peace terms that were honorable to us and acceptable to us by reason of our having our forces kept intact. Had Hitler's declarations in Mein Kampf many years earlier been a trick, he would have invaded us in 1940, or shortly after, when we were in the weakest possible position to resist an invasion. And as the first step towards that invasion, he would have directed his armies to cut off our withdrawal at Dunkirk, as every military historian of repute admits they could easily have done. And quite apart from these facts, what conceivable logic could there have been, given all that we know about Hitler's aims for German expansion, living room, and economic autarky, in an attack on Britain? Where was he going to find living room in our country, apart from a few of the wildest areas of northern Scotland? Hardly worth going to war with what was then a major power. What raw materials did we then possess that Germany did not already possess? And what about the British Empire? Any attack on any part of the empire would have involved the moving of German armies many thousands of miles, in most cases across the oceans. The sheer logistics of the operation would have made it ridiculous. Just as ridiculous as the idea, employed to get America into the war, that Hitler intended to invade the United States. Now, there is no doubt that if Hitler's European aims had succeeded, and he had built this mighty German Reich extending from the west bank of the Rhine right into the black earth regions of the Ukraine and to the oil wells of the Caucasus, it would have established Germany as an extremely strong power, a superpower, in fact, and therefore one which would exert very great weight in world affairs. It was quite understandable that the leaders of Britain should be apprehensive about the ramifications of that power. And if that was the extent of British concern over the growth of National Socialist Germany, that would not have been unreasonable. But what British statesmanship had to do, and should have done, in that situation, was sit down and consider, coolly and rationally, what were the practical options open to our country. In 1914, Britain and France had gone to war and made a vast expenditure of treasure and blood to prevent the emergence of Germany as the dominant power on the mainland of Europe, to prevent Germany from becoming too big and too strong. And what had this achieved? The embitterment of Anglo-German and Franco-German relations for long afterwards, the ruination of Europe, the collapse of Imperial Russia and the victory of communism in Russia. Finally, the re-emergence of German power again, in just a few years afterwards, in a new form. All the death and carnage of the Somme and Verdun was for nothing. Absolutely nothing. Intelligent and far-sighted statesmen would have learned from that experience. But the sort of leaders we had in the 30s, and since, were incapable of learning anything. 20 years afterwards, they repeated the whole thing all over again. What they should have learned was that the price to be paid for the prevention of German dominance on the mainland of Europe would always be too high. It should have been absolutely plain to these leaders in the 1930s that National Socialist Germany represented a power so formidable that it could only be destroyed at the cost of Britain and France destroying themselves as well in the process, and at the cost of bringing both Russia and America into the anti-German coalition. The obvious result of this would be that you would have on the mainland of Europe an aggressive military power, Soviet Russia, bigger and more dangerous than Germany, and far less friendly to British interests. The choice, in other words, was a Nazi empire in Europe or a communist empire in Europe. Every sane national interest at that time dictated that Britain should opt to come to terms with National Socialism in preference to coming to terms with communism. And every event that has happened on the stage of world politics since that time has confirmed this. But let us be clear about what we mean by coming to terms. When I say come to terms, I do not mean capitulation. There never was any necessity for Britain to capitulate to Hitler, where any vital British interest was concerned. Let us not forget that at that time Britain was still in possession of a vast empire. If we were concerned at the ramifications of this great increase in German power, if we were worried at the prospect that offered us for the more distant future, then the quite obvious course was to dedicate ourselves to the build-up of an impregnable British power by the consolidation and the development of the resources of our then enormous empire. In that event, no matter how powerful Germany may eventually become, and even supposing that later on in the course of world affairs, British and German interests collided, such would be the strength of our country and its dominions that no German leader in his right mind would risk attacking us. That was the obvious course open to British statesmen in the 1930s who were preoccupied with the balance of world power. But none of this was being done at the time that our politicians were howling for the blood of Germany. The British armed forces were being neglected by being left with obsolete weapons and training. Pacifism ran rampant through our intellectual and cultural life and was rotting the British will to fight for anything. Equally neglected were the resources of empire, which alone could have enabled a build-up of British power and a power with Germany. While our politicians were squawking that we shouldn't give the empire away to Hitler, an absurd hypothesis because he never wanted it, Those same politicians were all in favour of giving the empire away to Mahatma Gandhi, or some other Oriental babu who happened at the time to be the fashionable hero of Bloomsbury. And in Britain itself, the politicians were proving incapable of grappling with the massive internal problems besetting our country. The problems of unemployment, of industrial backwardness, of the ruin of the countryside, of urban slums and squalor. All problems that were being tackled with vigor and with success by those who had led the national revolutions in Europe and who had united their countrymen in the most far-reaching schemes of national reconstruction, who had produced a splendid, fit, strong, and disciplined youth dedicated to national service and duty, while our own youth lounged around the street corners and the coffee bars, out of condition and with nothing useful to do. If our leaders wanted to safeguard the security of Britain and her far-flung empire in the face of powerful international rivals, the one way they might do it was the one way they adamantly rejected: to learn something from the achievements of these new regimes that were supposed to threaten us, and to apply some of their methods of national organization to the purpose of organizing ourselves. To apply the same order of dynamic leadership and energy to making our own country united and strong that others had applied in making their countries united and strong. It didn't mean that every practice employed on the continent had to be copied exactly in this country. It didn't mean that we had to ape the goose-stepping and salutes of the fascist movements overseas. It didn't mean that we should sacrifice our traditional British qualities as innovators, as creators of our own ideas and schemes. But it did mean that we should acknowledge that the old system in Britain was rotten and decayed. It did mean that a national revolution was as necessary in our country as it had been in other countries, and that we, using a combination of ideas learned from others and originating from amongst ourselves, should bring about such a revolution or consign our country and its empire to oblivion. Had these necessities been recognized, a new Britain would have arisen, a Britain strong enough to be secure, whether it be against a German threat or a Soviet threat or any other threat. This was the course which British leaders should have chosen in the 1930s, but it was a course only possible if we had avoided war in Europe with Germany. But as we all know, our leaders did not choose that course. Their hatred of National Socialism and of fascism so totally consumed them that it came to override the preservation of Britain itself and the laying of the foundations of a secure British future. In the drive to destroy National Socialism and Fascism, they destroyed everything that might have been worth defending in our own country. As should have been clear from the outset, with a Britain weak, industrially backward, badly armed, and with no proper organization of her empire, the only way for fascism and National Socialism to be destroyed was by the bringing of America and communism into the heart of Europe and by making Britain the junior partner of America in the post-war world. We are still with the same kinds of leaders today as those leaders we had in the 30s. We are still with the same system, the system that they refused to change. And the tradition has continued, the tradition of appeasing our natural enemies and picking quarrels with our natural friends. While British leaders today crawl abjectly before the nabobs of the Afro-Asian bloc and wine and dine with the bosses of the Kremlin, we have destroyed white Rhodesia. We have alienated South Africa. We have alienated the Arabs in the Middle East. We're on our way to alienating Australia. We have long ago abandoned Canada. We have forsaken and betrayed New Zealand. At every turn during this century, when it comes to choosing enemies and friends, we have chosen the wrong enemies and the wrong friends. all the problems that were with us in the 30s, the problems which defeated the pygmies of politics of that period, are still with us today, and equally defeat the pygmies that have taken their place. The problems of unemployment, industrial backwardness, rural ruin, urban slums, they're all still here. And not content with that, the pygmy politicians of our own generation have imported an additional problem, the problem of color, the problem of racial incompatibility between different communities in this country, the problem which exploded in their faces in the race riots of 1981. This is why the events of that earlier period are so relevant to us today. This is why they cannot be buried in the archives of history and forgotten. For the world we live in today, the Britain we live in today, is our inevitable inheritance from that earlier period. We are suffering from the same types of leaders who inevitably go on making the same old mistakes. So what did we preserve by the sacrifices of 1939-45? We preserved only one thing, a corrupt, putrid, and decayed political system, and the vested interests which feed upon that system. That is what we preserved. That is what we fought to keep. It's not too late to remedy this tragic state of affairs. There is still time for us to act, to change things, and give this country a different direction. But we will not be able to act wisely and prudently, let alone find the right direction, unless we understand where we have gone wrong in the past. This talk is just a small contribution to that understanding. I hope it convinces you, but I hope it does something more. I hope it moves you to action, because only by action, the determined action of great numbers of people in this country, are we going to reverse the tragic consequences of the folly of the old gang of political leaders and build something from out of the ruins that they have created.